Instead of buying supermarket veggies from another hemisphere, how about farming fresh stuff on city rooftops instead? This hour, urban agriculture, from beekeeping in Paris to fish farms in Chicago, and we'll talk with the founder and chief farmhand of a chicken and veggie farm on an old industrial lot in Philadelphia. Is this the future of food? If you hunger for some stinging nettle pizza, or maybe some dandelion flower jelly, it's the joy of eating your garden weeds. Why not turn these pesky plants into dinner? All that and what spot on your body do you like to scratch most? Science is searching for an answer. What do you think? Well, coming up after this break. Stay with us. Hi, Ira Flatow here. You won't believe it. Something happened to our website. It got an extreme makeover. Go over to our website, have a look, and let us know what you think. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. If you live in a big city, there's no shortage of places to buy groceries. You got your supermarkets, your delis, your farmers markets, your sidewalk fruit stands. Seems like a limitless supply of food, right? But if you stop the delivery trucks, experts say a city's food would run out in just 3 days. So to be on the safe side, why not grow more food in this city instead of trucking it in from someplace else, some other country, some other hemisphere? That's what's on my next guest's suggestion list in her new book, Food and the City, Urban Agriculture and the New Food Revolution. And urban agriculture is not just about fruits and veggies. People are raising chickens and pigs in cities, too. They're farming fish. They're even making honey on rooftops. And if urban farming is not for you, how about eating the greens already growing wild, the weeds in your yard? That's right. Try frying up some dandelion heads for a delicious snack, adding the leaves themselves to a salad. One of my next guests is a professional forager, and she has some tips and recipes for us. So if you want to talk about urban gardening, about foraging for food, how to find food on your own, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. Maybe you've got some tips for us and some of your favorite forage foods, or you've got a favorite urban farm that you're trying to set up. Maybe we'll give you some tips. 1-800-989-8255. Also, you can tweet us at SciFry and go to our website at sciencefriday.com and leave some messages there also. Jennifer Cockrell King is a food journalist and author of Food and the City, Urban Agriculture and the New Food Revolution. She joins us from the CBC in British Columbia. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello.
Hey there. Mary Seaton Corboy is the co-founder and chief farmhand at Greensgrow Farm in Philadelphia, and she joins us from WHYY in Philly. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Tama Matsuaka Wong is a forager, and she is a forager for the restaurant Danielle in New York City. She's also author of the forthcoming book, Foraged Flavor, Finding Fabulous Ingredients in Your Backyard or Farmer's Market. She joins us from Atlantic City, New Jersey. Welcome to Science Friday, Tama.
Thank you for having me, Ira.
You're welcome. Mary, let's start with you. You started Greensgrow Farm in Philadelphia 15 years ago. Wow. You've been at the game for a while.
I was seven when I started, yes.
Really?
Yeah. So there's no child labor laws for farms, not ones that I knew anything about.
I'll bet. Well, tell us what's the definition of an urban farm?
I would say set inside a city, and in our case, we happen to believe that it's an operation that exists to grow product for sale or for trade, as opposed to for your own pleasure and consumption.
Mm. Do you have to go out and find the real estate, some abandoned lot on your own?
Well, in Philadelphia, that wasn't terribly hard to do. We have about 30,000 abandoned lots in Philadelphia. But yes, we did have to go out and find the lot. And we found an old EPA cleanup site that fit the bill.
Did people think you were crazy at that time?
I'm pretty sure they still think I'm crazy. But yes, they particularly thought I was crazy then.
Jennifer Cockrell King, your new book, Food in the City, surveys all sorts of urban farms and the history of the idea. How far back does this idea of urban agriculture go?
Well, originally we moved to good farmland, and we built cities basically on top of good farmland. So, you know, growing food in cities and building cities on good farmland is as old as, you know, settling together. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we tend to think of urban agriculture, which is the new term for growing food and producing food in cities. You know, that's the new term. But when you think back even two or three generations, we had vacant lot gardening, victory gardens, relief gardens in the Depression. So this is not a new concept.
Mm-hmm. You start your book in Paris, right? The birth of modern urban agriculture?
Yeah, Paris. It was interesting for me to find out that, you know, in medieval times in Paris, they developed gardens with a bunch of different techniques, I guess you'd call them. So we still call it French intensive agriculture. So using stone walls to enclose gardens, cold frames, and raised bed gardenings and lots of compost. And all these things came together in Paris to create a really fantastic flourishing of urban agriculture in the mid-19th century.
Mm-hmm. Now, you are a forager, and you have an interesting history of how you got connected with Danielle restaurant. Tama, tell us how that happened. You happened to be eating dinner there and brought some stuff with you?
Yes. I guess I always should say that I do have an obsession with plants, and so I'm always looking at plants and seeing what they are. And I was eating dinner there, and some friends that were taking us urged me to bring in some stuff that I knew was edible and that we've been eating at home to the restaurant. And so they decided to make a couple things on for our dinner. And I went down to the kitchen and asked me what else I had in my meadow. And I said to the chef de cuisine, Eddie Leroux, what do you want? And he said, bring me everything. So I started.
Wow. And the rest is history. How much stuff did he want after a while? Did you just bring bags and bags of stuff?
No. Well, in the beginning, it was really almost like a research project. So yeah. I would bring in tons and tons of samples of different things, maybe hundreds of plants and parts of plants at different times of the season. And so it was only after more than a year of going through everything that he decided which things he wanted to put on the menu and wanted more volume.
Does foraging have seasons? Are we in a good foraging season now, the spring, early summer?
Yes, spring is probably one of the best times, but I pretty much forage about 10 months of the year in the Mid-Atlantic region.
And what makes spring so good?
Spring is so good because everything's new and green and tender and hasn't really gone to seed yet.
You mean weeds?
Yes.
There are a lot of weeds in the spring. But you don't call them weeds. We should not call them weeds if we're eating them, right?
Well, I think we can call them weeds. I just think we have a bad – it's more our attitude or our concept of what we've been thinking are weeds are things that we don't like. But actually, weeds are just things that aren't growing where we want them to grow. Mm. So they could actually be a culinary delight from another country.
What would be the most common weed we could go out now and harvest from our backyard?
Well,
or
right now I actually went out this morning because I have to do a presentation to Slow Food after this. And so I went out to bring some samples from my little vegetable 3x6 foot container vegetable bed. And I found in there chickweed, some wild mustards, ground ivy, lamb's quarters, Asiatic dayflower, wild garlic, and dead nettle.
Wow.
So, and my peas have not come up yet.
This is all before the quote-unquote conventional veggies come up.
So, I think anybody could find things in just a, you know, whether it's a container or a small planter even.
How about dandelions?
I do still have a few dandelions, although now, it's getting towards the end.
Tell us about that. You have to know when to harvest a dandelion, right?
Yeah. So the other thing I would say is that just because something is edible doesn't mean it's going to taste good. We're not – that when we're talking about urban agriculture, at this point I don't think we're trying to talk about survival food or we're talking about space shuttle type food. So you really want to pick the things that taste good and also the right ways to prepare them. And that's why I really worked with a chef who could help that. So with dandelions, I would say the leaves are really – great before the plant flowers, and you would probably want to have it in some kind of a vinaigrette because the vinegar cuts any kind of bitterness or bite, or with a fatty meat.
Now, Mary, when you set up an urban farm, do the neighbors like you?
Yes and no, I would have to say. I'd like to think in our neighborhood they like me.
Did you have to get them to have you become an acquired taste, so to speak?
Kind of like dandelion weeds, yes. yes. When we started out, they just didn't get what we were doing. So I certainly, when I talk to people who are interested in starting urban farms, I say that you really... not everybody wants an urban farm in their community, and you really have to do a fair amount of work to work with the community and get community buy-in, because you probably, particularly if you're in a distressed neighborhood or something, your farm's not going to last very long if their neighbors don't like you.
But if
there's many things one can do to disturb the life of a farm.
I'll bet. And your farm is in a low-income community in Philly. Can you get local fooderies to buy from your urban farm?
We started out selling exclusively to restaurants. Mm-hmm. Ironically, mesclun salad greens 15 years ago, which were considered weeds. So it's all a matter of the packaging, I guess. Now they're sort of ubiquitous, and we've gone on to do other things. But the people... in our immediate neighborhood, I would say, are probably not as interested. There's not as much buy-in to the buy local or organic movement as there are in other neighborhoods. It's an economic indicator, certainly, and it's also a matter of what their particular food history is.
Yeah, do you have to get special zoning in cities so you can? You know, I know there are a lot of pocket parks that were going bad in New York for a while, and people tried to turn them into little farms or little gardens.
Well, you do, and every city is very different, and there's some cities, I think in Seattle, they had it be Year of the Urban Farm. In Philadelphia, they're rewriting the zoning code, and they are including, for the first time in the modernist revision of the zoning code, they are including urban agriculture, so you can have the kind of outbuildings that are generally associated with having a farm. But not every place is going to want one. As I said, two years ago, the city of Philadelphia itself tried to start an urban farm project on land that it owned, and the neighborhood resoundingly rejected it. And as a matter of fact, they had their city councilmen fight it and have legislation that said that you couldn't have any farms there. So you definitely have to have zoning. You have to have you should have licenses. You have to have permits. You have to have insurance. It's not very different from having any other business, quite honestly. Mm.
We're going to take a break and take all your calls about foraging and urban farming with Jennifer Cockrell King, Mary Seaton Corby, and Tama Matsuoka Wang. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. You could tweet us at SciFry. SCIFRI. Don't go away. We'll be right back with some suggestions and even recipes for what to do with some stuff you can forage. Stay with us. Ira here, and I want to thank you for listening and for making this podcast possible. And if you like what we do, our radio show, podcasts, Facebook, Twitter, and more, if you appreciate that and you can afford to pitch in, I invite you to contribute whatever you can by pressing on the donate button on your smartphone or iPad app, or going to our website at sciencefriday.com and making a tax-deductible donation. Thank you. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about urban agriculture and foraging for veggies and wild things in your own backyard, your own neighborhood. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the phones. Tim in Portland, Oregon. Hi, Tim.
Hi there, Ira.
Hi there. Go ahead.
My comment is regarding using these rooftop systems in inner city applications, and also where there are large industrial buildings. And I've been reading also about not just growing vegetables, but also using them as a wildlife habitat for wild birds and animals. And I think that's really good for the environment, and I really applaud that. But it seems like it's in conflict with the pushes for solar energy and put solar panels in these same locations. And from a benefit to man point of view, I'm curious which would win out over that.
All right. Thanks for your question. Good question. Jennifer, you want to take that on?
Sure. Well, you know, you have solar panels to create energy. And you just have to ask why you're creating this energy. If you've got a rooftop garden that's mitigating the heat loss from your building, or it's saving you from running your air conditioner during the summer, you're definitely ahead of the game, because you actually have food production as a byproduct as well with a rooftop garden. And, you know, if you're providing a habitat for things like urban bees, you're doing a great service to your food ecosystem. One mouthful in three in our diets is directly or indirectly benefiting from honeybee pollination. Mm. So, you know, you think about it as a global picture, and you ask yourself, well, why do we need this solar energy? What are we using this energy production for? If we can actually just cut our energy consumption, you're ahead of the game with some fresh veggies.
Mm-hmm. In your book, you write about a place many people might think of as a hotbed of urban agriculture, and that is Cuba.
Yeah, Cuba went through an energy shock in the 1990s, where they had to figure out how to feed 11 million people with no fuel to run tractors for conventional agriculture, no fuel to transport the food into cities, where Cuba's very similar to North America. 80% of the people actually live in cities. And so they had to figure out a distribution system. And one thing about urban agriculture, we talk about how are we going to feed our global population of 7 billion people and counting. We actually overproduce food right now anyways. A lot of the problems with food security is a distribution problem. If you can move the food production into cities, you're actually solving that distribution problem right away, where you don't have to transport that food quite so far. So Cuba, they went through a very serious and sustained energy shock. And the way that they kept, you know, the population of Cuba from starvation was to build just hundreds and hundreds of urban farms right in cities. And these are about, you know, 2 to 3 acre farms. And they're almost like our little neighborhood grocery stores. So instead of a grocery store, there's an urban farm within a neighborhood. And on your way home from work, you just pop into the kiosk and see what 10 or 12 vegetables are available for you that day. And you carry on.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to the phones to Cynthia in Denver. Hi, Cynthia.
Hi.
Hi there.
I've always loved the idea of urban gardening. I have my little herbs in the windowsill, which is all I can do in my apartment. But I have these two concerns kind of in the back of my mind when I think about it. Both of them having to do with the environment of the city. Basically, how does city pollution affect the soil and the air that is getting into this food? And then also weather. You know, some places aren't so sunny or don't have as much access to water, like, you know, Arizona. And I know that both of those things could maybe create another level mm-hmm. of problems if it goes into a bigger scale. You know, if you've got this vision of, as I do, you know, seeing like urban gardens, you know, in every neighborhood, can we actually do that with the city environment?
Mm-hmm. Good question. Let me ask Mary to react. Mary Seton Corboy?
Well, I would say in answer to the question about water, one of the things that we have looked into that Greensgrove has been engaged in for many, many years is growing hydroponically, which is a water system that is a recirculating system. So you're actually using very little water to grow your plants. And that works and is very much a, no pun intended, growing concern in places like Arizona. As far as the pollution issue, that is something that certainly is a top priority, both in terms of capillary uptake, particularly in old cities that may have had industrial pasts, as Philadelphia and most of the cities in the Northeast Corridor are, and also in terms of airborne particulate matter. So you definitely have to keep those things in consideration. But I have to say, you have to keep those things in consideration in a rural environment also, where you have a drift from the farmer next door who may be using pesticides. We all have 95 corridors running right through, interstate corridors running right through rural areas. And so the EPA has done a fair amount of work as regards to looking at the issue of soil contamination in previous industrial reuse and what the standards should and could be. As a concern, we have always looked at that issue, and we have always tested for that issue, for both from the top and the bottom of the plant.
Yeah.
But I think that to say that you're not going to grow just because there's no sun or not as many moles of light of day as you might like or that the plants might prefer or because of the water issue, those things can be mitigated by – there are tremendous advances in growing, and particularly as in controlled environment agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
And that may very well be the future of what happens in cities, is that we're not going to take the exact replication of rural farms. We're going to be inventing new ways to farm in cities. That's where the advantages can come in.
Mm-hmm. Tama, in your book, Foraged Flavor, you have 88 recipes. We have a couple of those recipes up on our website at sciencefriday.com. And one in particular, chickweed crostini. I just had a harvest of chickweed on my lawn.
I know. The chickweed is having a huge year this year. It's supposed to be finished by now, but because, I don't know, the weather this spring was very strange, and it's just come back with a huge resurgence.
Well, you say harvest and eat it. And you have chickweed crostini on our website. What is that?
Yes. And I also like to say I never have to water my chickweed ever. So...
the thought of me eating chickweed is not, you know.
Yes. And so when, you know, people come and they say this is, and actually this is why we try to make it and do little demos, because people are so surprised at how amazing it tastes. And I think one of the problems that I think is because it doesn't really taste that good raw, at least from our point of view, meaning the chef, myself, my family. It kind of just tastes like grass if you eat it raw. And sometimes you look at these books and they say, you know, put it in a salad, and we think it just tastes like grass in a salad. So if you cook it, not too long, but cook it, you know, sort of wilted, and then you sort of are balancing it with other things, like the crostini is just like a, you know, on top of bread with a little bit of cheese and onions. And then all the flavors kind of balance each other, and the chickweed flavor of that green and freshness is just sort of brought out by everything else. And then it's fantastic.
Well, I have a bumper crop this year.
1-800. Yeah, it is a bumper crop.
It's amazing. 1-800-989-8255. Mark in Clover, South Carolina. Nice name for a city.
Hi.
Today.
I appreciate you guys taking my call. I'm a former homeless advocate, or I'm really still a homeless advocate. I was formerly homeless. And I met a guy in a motel one time who had a set of flashcards. It was all about edible plants. And I wondered if any of the panelists there, anybody had given any thought to providing any educational materials to homeless shelters and that sort of thing. Can we educate homeless people so that they can be fed, so they don't have to worry about whether they can get their next meal from the Salvation Army or whatnot?
Good question, Mark. Let me get an answer for you. Anybody want to jump in?
I guess I could say that, you know, I'm not really – I think it depends on where the shelter is and what the program is. But I definitely think there could be workshops and you could bring things. But I think you would want to be, you know, careful about identification and other things. You wouldn't just want to hand them a bunch of flashcards, I would think.
Yeah,
I wouldn't want people just going out and picking mushrooms and thinking that they're all a good idea.
All right.
Certainly, I understand that. I appreciate that, folks.
Thanks, Mark.
But I definitely think a supervised program could be something you could do.
Could get
SNAP recipients can they can buy seeds for gardens, for community gardens. So you can use your SNAP food stamps, essentially, to buy vegetable seeds.
Is there enough? Could there be jobs for people who are out of work, you know, collecting and foraging for restaurants? What is
income? I'm looking for some.
You're looking for people?
The foragers I know are usually out of work.
I am looking for some, so, yes.
There's a very interesting community garden, or not a community garden, but a commercial garden in Vancouver on the downtown east side, which is known as Canada's poorest postal code, zip code. And it's a commercial garden that teaches people from the downtown east side how to grow, how to market, how to retail, do accounting, and, you know, we talk about, you know, reskilling people and farming in cities. You've got a labor force that's available. And so the Soul Food Farm actually is a great training ground for all sorts of things like farming and accounting and marketing and retailing for people who need assistance to get back into the workforce. So it's community gardens and commercial farms in cities are very effective because that's where you generally have more labor force available for agriculture.
Jason Calhoun tweets a message in something I've wanted to know myself. He says, my 8-year-old asks if we can eat the wild raspberry strawberries growing in the backyard.
The wild raspberries. Okay, so they mean the strawberries or raspberries?
Oh, either
wild
one, raspberries okay. or strawberries
so
that you see growing.
Raspberries, as long as you know they're berries and they've got lots and lots of those tiny little globules, it's not one big glop, those are edible. And if your 8-year-old has a question, they can post it to our website with a photo. The strawberries are pretty much easy to tell, identify also. But I don't find the ones that are growing wild around mid-Atlantic and that are not alpine strawberries, we don't find the flavor to be very good.
Hmm. Yeah, they're kind of
right?
bland.
Yeah.
Yeah, actually kind of bitter.
But if they have a question, they can, if especially 8-year-olds, I think, are the great, they're naturals in the field.
What's the website?
And meadowsandmore.com. You can post a photo, and we have a botanical community that will answer.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to Gabe in Portland. Hi, Gabe.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. Long-time listener. I'm a student at Portland State, and at that school we do a lot of study in urban agriculture. And it dawned on me that there's really not a whole lot of education provided for children in the public school system as far as growing our own fruits and veggies. You know, I was taught mathematics and literature and things like that, but I have no idea how to grow my own fruits and vegetables. So when we're talking about how to provide a workforce or anything like that, people out of work, it helps if they're already trained and educated. And I was wondering if there's any movement afoot at the federal level or at any state level to provide legislation and funding so that our public schools can start teaching children how to garden.
Hmm. Mary Seton Corboy?
Well, I think this has been certainly Alice Waters and the Berkeley School projects have been in the are no longer considered cutting edge. It's been in the, it's been around for quite some time. More and more schools we find have adopted some kind of growing programs. I believe in Pennsylvania you may have to take a class in agriculture to graduate. We're basically still an agricultural state. So I think that it's probably something that a lot of places would like to have programs in. I would also imagine that that it's going to be something that'll be one of the first things to be cut because it's considered a sort of a fringe activity
like
as
music.
Opposed to whatever is considered the major thing that you're supposed to be learning in school today. But
let me remind
everybody
that this is Science Friday from NPR. And then you can go ahead now. I'm sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
Oh, I just wanted to say, going back to this issue, there are an awful lot of urban farms that are being used for reskill, retraining, reentry programs. And I think that it's very valuable and it's valuable work. We do have to – people who are interested in getting into urban agriculture do have to realize that they're going to have to make a distinction. Urban agriculture, like anything, can't be the answer to everything. And it's
Let me go to this question because we're running out of time. Maybe you can answer that question from Sean in Cincinnati. Hi, Sean.
Hi, Ira.
Hi there.
Hey. My question, what is the point?
All right. Well, that's succinct and to the point.
Right? Yeah. I needed a job. That was my point. So
that's what I'm wondering.
Yeah, well, that's my job. That's what I do. For us, it's commercial interest.
For the rest of us, you know what I mean? I mean, it just seems to me, that seems to make sense on paper. Lower our overall energy consumption as opposed to finding more ways to consume energy. But is that realistic? I mean...
Well, Sean, what's the point of gardening?
What's the point of gardening? Well, that's a good question. I mean, when did they ever teach gardening in schools? That's what I want to know.
That's what our last caller wanted to know. Thanks for the question. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's trying to say, I guess, something about what is the point of all of this?
Well, I think the bigger question is whether or not, you know, if we had a better food system, would urban agriculture be deemed necessary now? And urban agriculture is for a lot of people an answer to a food system, a large food system that has failed, where the urban consumer doesn't have a lot of say in what's produced and how it's produced, where the urban demographic is not necessarily paid attention to. It's a greening mechanism for cities. There's a myriad number of reasons why you would want to have urban agriculture. For us, as I say, it's a commercial concern. We have 20 employees and sales of over $1 million a year. So that's the reason for it for us. It's about job creation. It's about economic development. And it's about developing relationships with not just us, but developing relationships with our rural farming families bringing that food into the city.
Got to interrupt because we have to go to a break. Talking with Jennifer Cockrell King, food journalist and author of Food and the City, Urban Agriculture and the New Food Revolution. Mary Seton Corboy, co-founder and chief farmhand at Greens Grove Farm in Philadelphia. Tama Matsuaka Wong is a forager for the restaurant Danielle in New York. Author of the forthcoming book, Foraged Flavor, Finding Fabulous Ingredients in Your Backyard or Farmer's Market. We're going to take a break, come back and talk lots more about food and urban farming. Flora Lichtman's going to be here with a little video of our own little search for foraging for food in the park. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break.
Speak Spanish? Ahora, Science Friday, también en español. Encuentra lo mejor de la actualidad científica hispana y del mundo en sciencefriday.com/español.
You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking about urban farming, foraging for food with Jennifer Cockrell King, Mary Seton Corboy, Tama Matsuaka Wong. Our number 1-800-989-8255. A few more minutes to go. For urban farmers, Mary, or let me ask Jennifer. Jennifer, if you wanted to start your urban farm, you got to have a thick skin, it sounds like.
Yeah, and it's a lot of hard work, too.
Yeah.
I mean, sustainable living is about sweat equity a lot of the time. So it's physically demanding, as Mary can probably tell you. So you have to have a thick skin. You have to find out if your city allows certain types of urban agriculture activities where you live. And then you have to get to work. And a lot of people will say to you, what's the point of it? But my question to them would be, do you eat? How often do you eat? It's a necessity of life to eat. And if we have, a three-day supply of food within a modern city only, and there's a problem, everybody gets pretty hungry at the end of the third day. So that to me is the point, is a little bit of self-reliance and resilience and not depending on these supply lines to, you know, continually resupply our grocery stores. Because what happens if they don't?
Tama, do you think everybody can do what you did and go to their local higher-end restaurant with a bag of forage stuff and say, would you like more of this? Tastes good, you know, that sort of thing.
No, I think it was just fate. I was very lucky. And also, I'd say that even if you say you're going to do that, it was a huge amount of work to learn everything and get where we are. And so hopefully people can have the result of our efforts, because it was a huge amount of work in the end.
And Mary Seton Corboy, you think your Greens Grove Farm in Philadelphia, you say it's a million, grosses a million bucks and employs a lot of people. Suggest that for other people?
With a big vat of sunscreen, yes. Big vat of sunscreen.
And what about mosquitoes? How do you take care of those?
That's not so much a problem at our particular site, but just about everything else is. So
right.
Don't wish anything on me, Ira.
I'm not. I'm only wishing you the greenest and the rainiest of seasons, because we had a drought, as I'm sure you did too. And we're all hoping to be able to eat chickweed next year if I don't mow it all down, because I've now learned something new. Thank you all for taking time to be with us today. Tama Matsuaka Wong is
Thank
a
you.
Forager for a restaurant Danielle in New York and author of the forthcoming book, Foraged Flavor, Finding Fabulous Ingredients in your backyard or farmer's market. It's got 88 recipes. We have a couple of those recipes up on our website at sciencefriday.com if you'd like to see how to make chickweed into a delicious salad. Mary Seton Corboy is a co-founder and chief farmhand at Greens Grow Farm in Philadelphia. Jennifer Cockrell King, a food journalist and author of Food and the City, Urban Agriculture, and the New Food Revolution. Thanks for being with us all today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ira.
We're not done with foraging for food, because for dessert.
Sure.
Flora Lichtman is here. And she's got you want a lesson in how to forage for food in the most unusual place. Flora has got it this week, right?
Yes. We looked at foraging in New York. I mean, everyone knows New York is a place where you can find food, right?
Absolutely.
But you can also find food in
Ooh,
New York,
nice.
If you know
nice.
What I mean. Thanks.
Yes,
this is radio. Anyway, so we looked at a few different foragers, sort of case studies in foraging. And you can find mushrooms in the park, and we talk about that, and sea rocket at the beach, which is in the mustard family.
Sea rocket.
Yeah. Punch up your sandwich
wow.
when you're picnicking. One unusual foraging case study was Ari Glogauer. He was looking for snails in his backyard.
Mm-hmm.
Escargot. Local to Brooklyn.
Escargot.
And the stars of our video this week really are Anya Pozdeva and Christopher Toole. And they're a vertically integrated farms. And they have this interesting story. They were in finance and traded their jobs for a new mission. They want to turn New York into a food production center. Basically, through a whole bunch of different means. So they're growing tilapia at a community center in the Bronx and in their apartment, I should
also
say.
Yeah.
And in other people's apartments. We visit another apartment in the Bronx and
right.
see some tilapia.
Mm-hmm.
They're foragers. In fact, one of their recipes is garlic mustard, which you can find. It's an invasive. It's all over. Check out the video. You can see what it looks like. You can turn it into pesto, it turns out.
Is that right?
Yeah. I had it raw
right.
on our shoot. It was actually pretty good.
Yeah, and what's also interesting is that they have gone to the parks here in New York and sort of like Johnny Appleseed, Johnny
yes.
something,
Johnny
Planter.
Johnny Food Farmer
food
in the
farmer.
City.
Is his secret that, well, not anymore. You've got them on video yeah. planting in the park system here.
Yeah, this idea really captured my imagination. The idea is to turn New York City's parks sort of clandestinely into edible forests, food forests.
Hmm.
So we were in Van Cortlandt Park in the Bronx, and if you walk through with Anya and Christopher, they can show you their secret spots where they've planted blueberry bushes and raspberry bushes. And when I was there with them, they were sort of turning a hill that was a little bit hard to get to, was sort of a treacherous chute into a lavender grove.
Okay.
Which was really neat. And so I asked, you know, the first question that came to my mind was, like, aren't you going to get in trouble?
Sure.
What
sure.
do the parks say about this?
A guy with his cop with his baton there.
Yeah, exactly. And they said that...
Sure, you're planting food here? Yeah, right. We've heard it all, you know.
But their point of view is that it's a public park, and they've talked to the park rangers, and they said, you know, if you saw a pumpkin growing, would you smash it? And of course, the park ranger said, no, you know, we wouldn't do that. So their idea is you're adding biodiversity to the park, and especially if you plant local things that are endemic, like a blueberry bush, you know, what's the harm
what's the
done?
Harm? Yeah. So
it was an interesting idea.
Yeah.
And if you go to Van Cortlandt Park, you might be able to score some berries also.
But, you know, this stuff grows wild in all the different parks, right?
That's right.
And there are these people, I'm sure people like them, must be spread out all over the country.
I think so. I wonder if this is a sort of secret underground move. Anyway, that's their goal.
That's their goal.
And, you know, they also sort of give foraging tips. And they wouldn't say, just go pick anything you see. You know, they're
right.
experts.
Right. As our food people said
that's
before,
right.
you have to know what a raspberry really looks
yeah,
like.
Yeah. This is not, Science Friday is not encouraging people to just go out and just start, like,
stay
filling
away
a bag.
From those mushrooms.
yeah.
You know?
Exactly.
Unless these are professionals.
Know. That's right. People are professionals. And when I was walking around with Anya, you know, she just knew, she had a very deep knowledge of the plants and how to prepare them. So, you know, Artemisia, you know, you might see it. You don't want to eat it raw. You want to turn it into a tea. But mm-hmm. I didn't know that until I had an expert with me to explain.
Yeah, so Flora went up there into Vancouver Park
Van Cortlandt.
Excuse me, I said Vancouver. We're talking about Vancouver all day.
Yeah.
Van Cortlandt Park, and you took your video camera, and they showed you the stuff that they were collecting, but it's not a lesson in identifying the plant. It's a lesson in what you can do with the park.
Yeah.
So if you really want to identify the stuff, you need a real manual. You need to know what you're doing.
Go get a field guide. Find someone who knows.
Right.
Yeah. But you can see this is sort of how people who are foraging, you know, how they're doing it.
All right. Thank you, Flora.
Thanks,
Ira. It's up there on our website at sciencefriday.com. It's a great little video, and if you're into it, it's really something you might want to do. Next up, mosquitoes, chicken pox, cheap wool. People can name 100 things that make them itchy, but no one can tell you why. It's had scientists scratching their heads for years. Has it got you scratching yours? Studies showed it just by listening to, say, a radio broadcast talking about certain uncomfortable sensations could have you squirming in your seat, fighting to scratch that itch already, yeah? On the phone is Mark Abrams, editor for the Annals of Improbable Research, who's going to tell us why you may already feel like scratching. Welcome to Science Friday, Mark.
Hi, Ira. Are you scratching?
I'm wondering, how many people are out there? Is the power of suggestion, does it work in scratching?
That was the big question. Scratching and itching are really mysterious. For as long as people have been digging into the nervous system, trying to figure out how the brain and the nerves work, they've been looking at itching and scratching as great mysteries. There have been lots of explanations, but nobody really knows how they work. And there have been, in the past 15 years, two studies that got at the big question of how much of this can happen just by suggestion.
Hmm. And in other words, if we get a group of people together and sort of suggest something that's scratchy, they'll start itching?
Yeah, yeah. So there was one study that was done about 10 years ago in Germany. They invited a lot of people to come to a movie theater. They were told that this was going to be filming a TV show. And they were shown first a bunch of slides of things that were thought to induce itching. They weren't told to itch or anything, but they were just shown these things. And then after that, they were shown a bunch of other slides of things like babies and soft down and soft skin that were thought to make people relax and be not itchy. What was really going on was the TV cameras were focusing on the audience, and they were recording the audience. And afterwards, the scientists had a bunch of people look at the videotapes and try to very carefully take records for each person in the audience of how often they scratched. And what they found, they say, is that while watching those slides of really itch-inducing things, people did scratch themselves a lot more. And then when they started to see the slides of nice, soft babies and things, they stopped scratching to a degree. So that was one experiment. About 5 years before that, in the U.S., at Indiana State University, there was a guy named Mitchell who was working on his Ph.D. dissertation, and he, on the surface, was interested in subliminal suggestions. You know those old stories about you go to a movie theater and they've stuck in these real quick flashes of words that say, buy popcorn. And the old stories are that people would rush out and buy popcorn. And nobody's sure that ever happened. So he was trying to look at this. And he got itching and scratching involved because he wanted some way that was inarguably evidence. And so he prepared some audio tapes. And one audio tape had subliminal messages of scratching, people saying scratch and itch and things like that. But the words were recorded so softly nobody could detect them, nobody could hear them. And then they put some music on top of that. So that was one group of people listened to that tape. Second group of people listened to a tape of just the music with no subliminal suggestions. And then a third group listened to a tape that had just somebody overtly saying itch and scratch. And the results came out not what they expected exactly. Results came out on the subliminal tape, almost nobody was itching. And most people were itching on the tape that had just music. And not so many were itching on the tape that was telling you to itch. So it was quite mysterious. And the result of both of these things, when you add them together, is that it's pretty much where people started. Nobody really understands a whole lot about how itching ties in with suggestions. Now, this sounds like funny stuff, and probably is, but on the other hand, there are a lot of people who suffer from itching, and it can be a terrible, horrible thing that goes on and can ruin people's lives. And doctors really, for the most part, don't know what to do about that.
Interesting. Talking with Mark Abrams on Science Friday from NPR about studies about itching and scratching. One other study that is interesting, and I'm itching right now. I wonder how many other people are itching as we're talking.
I don't intend to make you too much more uncomfortable, Ira, but could you tell me exactly where on your body you are itching?
I'm itching on my back. My back.
Okay. There's an experiment that was done recently. It was published just a few months ago. And it was done in, I think, four different countries, in the U.K., Saudi Arabia, the United States, and Singapore, I think, was the fourth one. And if they were scratching people, and they were trying to figure out, you know, there's some pleasure involved,
right,
can be, when you finally do scratch. So they were trying to measure that part of it. So they had some people who were trained to do the scratching using special brushes, and they would have them scratch on three different body parts. And periodically they would ask the person who was being scratched to indicate, a scale of 1 to 9, I think, how pleasurable it was. And what they ended up discovering, they said, was this really is very different on different body parts. They measured the forearm, the back, and then they also scratched on people's ankles. And they found that there's a great amount of pleasure initially when you start scratching any of those places. But the only place they found where the pleasure keeps on, you can keep scratching for a long time and it stays pleasurable, is on the ankle.
Wow. Oh.
And nobody really knows why.
You can scratch. In other words, you can satisfy the itch on the back and the arm, but you can keep scratching your ankle and it still feels good.
Yeah, so exactly that. The first two, you satisfy it, but it's just satisfied. The third one, you're getting some pleasure. And also, nobody really has any clear idea whether this is tied to something important or trivial or what. It's really a deep mystery.
Wow. So scratch. So. Your feet are near the ground, right? You'd think that they would be abrasive things down there that make you want to scratch.
Yeah.
So maybe your ankles, maybe that's the pleasurable part of, I'm just guessing here.
I guess, yeah. You can, the more you think about it, the more you can start to think of all kinds of interesting experiments you could do. And people have done a lot of them. It's just nobody really seems to have done many experiments that told them anything very definite. They always end up going in a circle with just, well, the only way to put it is scratching your head about how does this stuff work.
Yeah. You know what they say, you're going to need an ocean of calamine lotion.
Some of them say that, yeah.
All right, Mark, that's very interesting. Thank you. Thank you for enlightening us about scratching and itching. And now I'm squirming. So
good luck, Ira.
Thanks a lot. Mark Abrams is editor and co-founder of the Annals of Improbable Research, as well as founder and master of ceremonies for the Ig Nobel Prize. That you can hear those ceremonies every Friday, the Friday after Thanksgiving, right here on Science Friday. And he also writes a weekly column for The Guardian. Our program senior producer is Annette Heist. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is our multimedia editor. Our associate senior producer is Christopher Intagliata. Namisha Serene Anand is our producer. Luis Quevedo is our Spanish language producer. Sam Flato, our production assistant. Neil Rauch, our technical director at the controls here in New York. Our iPhone app is produced by Pastime Software. Wayne Hoxie does our Android app. Thanks for listening. I'm Ira Flato.